matter of pride. The country was getting ready for the presidential elections. At a dinner of conservative politicians in town, Esteban Trueba made the acquaintance of Count Jean de Satigny. He wore kid-skin shoes and jackets of raw linen, did not perspire the way other mortals did, smelled of English cologne, and was always perfectly tanned from his habit of knocking a ball through a little hoop with a stick in the midday sun. When he spoke, he drew out the final syllables of words and swallowed his R's. He was the only man Esteban had ever met who polished his fingernails and put blue eyewash in his eyes. He had calling cards with his family crest on them and respected all the known rules to urbanity, as well as some of his own invention, such as eating artichokes with tongs, which provoked general stupefaction. Men made fun of him behind his back, but it was soon clear that they were imitating his elegance, his kidskin shoes, his indifference, and his civilized manner. The title of Count put him on a different footing from the other immigrants who had arrived from Central Europe, fleeing the plagues of the preceding century, from Spain, escaping the war, from the Middle East, with their Turkish bazaars, and from Armenia, with their typical food and their trinkets. The Count de Satigny did not have to work for a living, as he let everyone know. His chinchilla business was just a hobby. Esteban Trueba had seen chinchillas prowling on his land. He had shot at them to keep them from devouring his crops, but it had never occurred to him that those insignificant rodents could be turned into ladies' coats. Jean de Satigny was looking for a partner to put up the capital, the work, and the stockhouses. Someone who would run all the risks and divide the profits 50-50. Esteban Trueba was no adventurer, but the French count had the winged grace and ingenuity to seduce him. So he spent many sleepless nights mulling over the idea of the chinchilla farm and working out the figures. Meanwhile, Monsieur de Satigny spent long periods at Tres Marias as an honored guest. He played with his little ball in the noonday sun, drank enormous quantities of unsweetened melon juice, and delicately poked around Blanca's ceramics. He even suggested that she export her work to other places, where there was a guaranteed market for indigenous crafts. Blanca tried to disabuse him of his error, explaining that neither she nor her work contained a drop of Indian blood, but the language barrier prevented him from understanding her point of view. The Count was a social acquisition for the Trueba family. From the moment he arrived at the hacienda, they were showered with invitations to neighboring properties, to meetings with the local political authorities, and to all the cultural and social events in the area. People wanted to get close to the Frenchman, hoping that some of his refinement would rub off on them. Young girls sighed at the thought of meeting him, and mothers longing to have him as their son-in-law fought for the honor of having the family as their guest. Men envied Esteban Trueba, who had been chosen for the chinchilla farm. Clara was the only one who was not impressed by him or carried away by his manner of peeling an orange with a knife and fork, never touching it with his fingers, and cutting the peel in the shape of a flower, or by his skill at quoting poets and philosophers in his native language. Clara had to ask his name every time she saw him, and was always disconcerted to find him in his silk robe in the bathroom of her house. But Blanca enjoyed herself with him, and was glad for a chance to dress up in her finest clothes, arrange her hair especially for him, and set the table with the English china and the silver candlesticks. "At least he's civilizing us," she said. Esteban Trueba was less impressed by the nobleman's bragging than he was by the chinchillas. He wondered why in God's name he had not thought of tanning their skins himself, instead of wasting so much time raising all those stupid chickens that died of diarrhea at the drop of a hat, and all those cows that had to chew through acres of pasture, and a whole box of vitamins for one lousy quart of milk, and were always covered with shit and flies. But Clara and Pedro Segundo Garcia did not share Esteban's enthusiasm for the rodents. She, for humanitarian reasons, since she thought it was horrendous to raise them just so you could skin them, and he because he had never heard of keeping rats in special houses. One night, the Count went out to smoke one of his Oriental cigarettes, specially imported from Lebanon, wherever that was, as Thriba always said, and to inhale the scent of the flowers, which rose in great mouthfuls from the garden, filling every room in the house. He walked up and down the terrace, taking in the expanse of the land around the house, sighing aloud at the thought of that exuberant nature which could assemble in the most godforsaken country on the planet, mountains and sea, valleys and skyscraping peaks, rivers of crystalline water, and a peaceful fauna that allowed you to wander tranquilly without having to worry about poisonous snakes or starving beasts. And, completing his idea of perfection, there were no resentful Negroes or wild Indians. He was fed up with traveling through exotic countries, selling shark fin aphrodisiacs, ginseng to cure all ills, carved Eskimo statues, stuffed Amazonian piranhas, and chinchillas for ladies' coats. He was 38 years old, at least that is what he admitted to, and he felt that he had finally found paradise on earth, where he could settle into some sort of easygoing business with a few ingenious partners. He sat down on a log to smoke in the darkness. Suddenly, he saw a shadow moving. For a fleeting second, he thought it might be a thief, but then he discounted that, because robbers in a place like this were as unlikely as wild animals. He approached cautiously and saw that it was Blanca, who was letting her legs out the window and slipping down the wall like a cat, falling noiselessly onto the hydrangeas below. She was dressed like a man, because by now the dogs knew her and she no longer needed to go naked. Jean de Saint-Igny observed her walk off under the eaves of the house and in the shadow of the trees. He was going to follow her, but then he thought better of it. He was frightened of the dogs, and he realized that he did not need to follow her to know where a young girl would be going who escaped through her bedroom window in the dead of night. But he was worried, because what he had just seen jeopardized the scheme he had in mind. The next day, the Count asked for Blanca Treva's hand in marriage. Esteban, who had not had a chance to get to know his daughter, mistook her placid amiability and her eagerness to set the table with the silver candlesticks for love. He was delighted that his daughter, so bored and in such bad health, should have managed to land the most sought-after bachelor in the area. What could he have seen in her, he wondered, taken aback. He told the Count that he would have to discuss it with his daughter, but that he was sure there would be no objection, and that, as for himself, he was overjoyed to welcome him into his family. He summoned his daughter, who was giving a geography class in the school, and locked himself in his office with her. 5 minutes later, the door swung open, and the Count saw the young girl exit with her cheeks aflame. She shot him a murderous look and turned her face away. Someone less tenacious would have packed his bags and gone to stay in the only hotel in town, but the Count told Esteban that he was sure of winning the girl's love if they only gave him enough time. Esteban Trueba told him he was welcome to stay in Tres Marias for as long as he thought necessary. Blanca said nothing, but from that day on she refused to join them at the table and missed no opportunity to make the Frenchman feel unwanted. She put away her party dresses and the silver candlesticks and carefully avoided him. She told her father that if he ever mentioned marriage again, she would take the first train out of town and return to her convent as a novice. "You'll change your mind," Esteban Trueba roared. "I doubt it," she replied. The arrival of the twins at Tres Marias that year was a great relief. They brought a gust of freshness and vitality to the oppressed atmosphere of the hacienda. Neither of the two brothers appreciated the Frenchman's charms, despite his discreet attempts to win their favor. Jaime and Nicolas made fun of his fine manners, his effeminate shoes, and his foreign name, but Jean de Satigny did not seem to mind. His good humor disarmed them in the end, and they wound up spending the remainder of the summer on good terms. They even joined forces with him to lure Blanca out of her determined obstinacy. "You're already 24, sister. Do you want to end up saying rosaries for the poor?" They tried to convince her to cut her hair and copy the dresses that were all the rage in the fashion magazines, but she had no interest in those exotic styles, which would not have had a prayer of surviving the dust bowl of the countryside. The twins were so different, they did not even look like brothers. Jaime was tall, robust, timid, and studious. Since his school required it, he had managed to develop an athletic build in gym, but he viewed sports as a dull and useless pastime. He could not understand how Jean de Satigny could spend the whole morning hitting a ball with a stick just to knock it through a metal hoop when it was so much easier to put it in with your hand. Jaime had various strange habits that became evident around that time and grew more pronounced over the course of his life. He did not like anyone to breathe too close to him, shake his hand, ask him personal questions, ask to borrow books, or write him letters. This made his dealings with people difficult, but it did not isolate him, because within 5 minutes of meeting him, it was clear that, despite his peevish attitude, he was generous and candid and had a tremendous capacity for kindness, which he tried in vain to cover up because it embarrassed him. He was much more interested in others than he let on, and it was easy to move him. The tenants of Tres Marias called him the little patron, and he was the one they turned to whenever they needed something. Jaime would listen to them without saying a word, respond in monosyllables, and then turn his back on them. But he would not rest until he had solved their problem. He was unsociable, and his mother said that even as a child he would not let anybody touch him. From the time he was a little boy, he had had outlandish habits. He would take his clothes off and give them to someone else. Affection and the expression of emotions struck him as signs of inferiority. Only with animals did he relax his exaggerated modesty. He rolled on the ground with them, ran his hands over them, fed them directly in the mouth, and slept curled up with the dogs. He would do the same with very young children, provided no one was watching. When there were other people around, he preferred to play the strong, solitary man. His 12 years of British schooling had failed to give him spleen, which was considered a gentleman's most attractive trait. He was incorrigibly sentimental. This was why he had become interested in politics and decided not to be a lawyer, as his father wished, but a doctor who would help the needy, as his mother, who knew him better, had suggested. Jaime had played with Pedro Tercero Garcia throughout his childhood, but not until that year did he come to admire him. Blanca had to forgo 2 of their meetings by the river in order for the young men to meet. They talked of justice, of equality, of the peasant movement, and of socialism, while Blanca listened with impatience, wishing they would hurry up and finish their discussion so she could be alone with her lover. This friendship linked the two boys until death, without Esteban Trevas ever finding out. Nicolás was as pretty as a girl. He had inherited his mother's delicate, transparent skin, and was small, astute, and fleet-footed as a fox. He was blindingly intelligent and effortlessly surpassed his brother in everything they undertook together. He had invented a game to torture him with. He would take the opposing side on any argument and would argue so well and so persuasively that he always ended convincing Jaime that he was wrong, forcing him to admit his error. "Are you sure I'm right?" Nicolás would finally ask his brother. "Yes, you're right," Jaime would grudgingly admit, with a rectitude that prevented him from arguing in bad faith. "Good," Nicolás would exclaim, "because now I'm going to prove that you're right and I'm wrong. I'm going to give you the arguments you would have given me if you were smarter." Jaime would lose patience and start beating up his brother, but he would quickly regret it, because he was so much stronger than Nicolás, and his own strength made him feel guilty. At school, Nicolás used his intelligence to pester others, and whenever he found himself faced with a violent situation, he would call in his brother to defend him while he egged him on from behind. Jaime got used to standing in for Nicolás, and it seemed perfectly normal to him to be punished instead of his brother, to do his homework and cover up his lies. Apart from girls, Nicolás's primary interest in that period of his life was to cultivate Clara's capacity for predicting the future. He bought books about secret societies, about horoscopes, and anything that had to do with the supernatural. That year, he also took to exposing miracles. He bought a popular edition of The Lives of the Saints and spent the summer looking for ordinary explanations of the most extraordinary spiritual feats. His mother made fun of him. "If you can't understand how the telephone works," she would say, "how do you expect to understand miracles?" Nicolás's interest in supernatural things had begun a few years earlier. On the weekends, when he was allowed to leave his boarding school, he would visit the three Mora sisters in their old mill to study various occult sciences. But it soon became abundantly clear that he had not the slightest talent for clairvoyance or telekinesis, and he was forced to be content with the mechanics of astrological charts, tarot cards, and the I Ching. And since one thing always leads to another, at the house of the Mora sisters, he met a beautiful young woman named Amanda, somewhat older than himself, who initiated him into yogic meditation and acupuncture, sciences that Nicolás later used to treat rheumatism and other minor pains, which was more than his brother would be able to do with the traditional medicine after 7 years of school. But that was all much later. That summer, he was 21, and he was bored in the country. His brother kept close watch to prevent him from giving the girls a hard time, for Jaime had proclaimed himself the protector of the maidenly virtues of Tres Marías. Despite this, Nicolás managed to seduce almost all the adolescent girls around, using acts of gallantry never seen before in those parts. The rest of his time, Nicolás spent investigating miracles, trying to learn the tricks his mother used to move salt cellars with her mind, and writing passionate stanzas to Amanda, who sent them back by return mail, corrected and improved, without deterring her admirer in the least. Old Pedro Garcia died a few days before the presidential elections. The nation was convulsed by the campaign. Special trains crossed the country from north to south, the candidates appearing at the rear with their retinue of proselytes, greeting everyone exactly the same way, promising exactly the same things, festooned with banners and roaring with a choral society and loudspeakers that shattered the tranquil landscape and stunned the cattle. The old man had lived so long that he was nothing more than a pile of glass bones covered by a yellow skin. His face was a latticework of wrinkles. He clacked as he walked, rattling like a pair of castanets, and since he had no teeth, he was forced to eat baby food. Though he was blind and deaf, he never failed to recognize things, and his memory of the past and the immediate present was remarkable. He died sitting in his wicker chair at dusk. He liked to sit in the doorway of his little house and feel the sun go down, which he could sense from the subtle change in temperature, the sounds in the courtyard, the haste of the cooks, and the silence of the hens. It was there that death found him. At his feet was his great-grandson, Esteban Garcia, who was by that time almost 10, driving a nail through the eyes of a chicken. He was the son of Esteban Garcia, the only bastard offspring of the patrón named for him. No one knew his origin, or the reason he had that name, except himself, because his grandmother, Pancha Garcia, had managed, before she died, to poison his childhood with the story that if only his father had been born in place of Blanca, Jaime, or Nicolás, he would have inherited Tres Marías and could even have been president of the republic if he wanted. In that part of the country, which was littered with illegitimate children and even legitimate ones who had never met their fathers, he was probably the only one to grow up hating his last name. He hated Esteban Trueba, his seduced grandmother, his bastard father, and his own inexorable peasant fate. Esteban Trueba did not treat him any differently from any of the other children around the property. He was simply one more in the pile of creatures who sang the national anthem in the schoolhouse and stood in line to receive their Christmas presents. Trueba had forgotten all about Pancha Garcia and the fact that he had had a child with her, much less the sullen little grandson who despised him but watched him from afar to imitate his gestures and his speech. The child would lie awake at night imagining all sorts of dreadful illnesses and accidents that could put an end to the life of the patron and his children so that he could inherit the property. Tres Marías would become his kingdom. He nursed these fantasies throughout his life, even long after it was evident that he would receive nothing by way of inheritance. He always reproached Trueba for the dark existence he had forged for him, and he felt constantly punished, even in the days when he had reached the height of his power and had them all in his fist. The child noticed that something in the old man had changed. He went up to him and touched him, and the whole body swayed. Pedro Garcia fell to the ground like a bag of bones. His eyes were covered by the milky film that had slowly screened out all light over the course of a quarter century. Esteban Garcia picked up his nail and was just about to stick it in his grandfather's eye when Blanca arrived and shoved him away, never suspecting that this evil, dark-skinned creature was her nephew, and that he would one day be the instrument of a tragedy that would befall her family. "Oh, God, he's dead," she sobbed, leaning over the body of the old man who had filled her childhood with stories and protected her clandestine love affair. Old Pedro Garcia was buried following a 3-day wake for which, on instructions from Esteban Trueba, no expense was spared. They placed his body in a coffin of rough pine and laid him out in his Sunday suit, the same one he had worn at his wedding, and whenever he went to vote or lined up for his 50 pesos at Christmas. They dressed him in his one white shirt, which was very loose around the neck because he had shrunk with age, and his mourning tie, with a red carnation on his lapel, as on all festive occasions. They held his jaw in place with a handkerchief and placed his black hat on his head because he had repeatedly declared that he wanted to take it off when he said hello to God. He had no shoes, so Clara took a pair that belonged to Esteban Trueba for everyone to see that he would not go barefoot to heaven. Jean de Satigny was excited about the funeral. He showed up with a camera and tripod he had extracted from his belongings and took so many portraits of the dead man that his relatives were afraid he might steal his soul, so they destroyed the plates. The wake was attended by peasants from throughout the region, because over the course of his century-long lifetime, Pedro Garcia had become related to many of the local farmers. The curandera arrived along with several Indians from her tribe, who began to weep for the deceased when she gave the order, and did not stop until the reveling was over 3 days later. People gathered outside the old man's house to drink wine, play the guitar, and keep an eye on the steers that were being roasted. Two priests on bicycles also arrived to bless the mortal remains of Pedro Garcia and oversee the funeral rites. One of them was a rubicund giant with a strong Spanish accent, Father José Dulce María, whose name was familiar to Esteban Trueba. He was just about to forbid him to set foot on the property when Clara convinced him that this was hardly the time to place his political enmities before the peasants' Christian fervor. "At least he'll bring a little order to matters of the spirit," she said. So in the end, Esteban Trueba welcomed him and invited him to stay in the house with his lay brother, who did not open his mouth and kept his eyes on the ground, his head bowed, and his hands joined. The patron was moved by the death of the old man who had saved the crops from the plague of ants, and his life as well, and he wanted everyone to remember this funeral as a major event. The priests assembled the tenants and the visitors in the little schoolhouse to read through the forgotten Gospels and say a Mass for the eternal rest of the soul of Pedro Garcia. Afterward, they withdrew to the room that had been reserved for them in the main house, while everybody else resumed the rowdy celebration that had been interrupted by their arrival. That night, Blanca waited for the guitars and the Indians' lament to quiet down and for everyone to go to bed before she jumped out her bedroom window and took off in her usual direction, protected by the shadows. She continued to do so for the next 3 nights, until the priests departed. Everyone except her parents knew that Blanca was meeting one of them down by the river. It was Pedro Tercero Garcia, who hadn't wanted to miss his grandfather's funeral, and took advantage of the borrowed cassock to harangue the workers house by house, explaining that the coming elections were their chance to shake off the yoke under which they had always lived. They listened in surprise and confusion. For them, time was measured in seasons and thought by generations. They were slow and cautious. Only the very young ones, those who had radios and listened to the news, those who sometimes went to town and talked with the union men, were able to follow his train of thought. The others listened to him because he was the hero the owners were after, but they were convinced that he was talking nonsense. "If the patron finds out we're voting socialist, we're done for," they said. "There's no way he can know. The ballots are secret," the false priest argued back. "That's what you think," replied his father, Pedro Segundo. "They say they're secret. But afterward, they always know exactly who we voted for. Besides, if your party wins, they'll throw us out. We'll lose our jobs. I've always lived here. What would I do?" "They can't throw you all out, because the owner loses more than you do if you go," countered Pedro Tercero. "It makes no difference who we vote for. They always win anyway." "They changed the ballots," said Blanca, who was at the meeting, sitting on the ground among the peasants. "This time they can't," said Pedro Tercero. "We'll be sending people from the party to watch the polling places and make sure they seal the ballot boxes." But the peasants did not trust him. Experience had taught them that in the end, the fox always eats the hens, despite the subversive ballads that were traveling from mouth to mouth, preaching just the opposite. Therefore, when a train came through carrying the new candidate of the Socialist Party, a charismatic, nearsighted doctor who could move huge crowds with his passionate speeches, they watched him from the station, observed in turn by the owners, who formed a fence around them, armed with shotguns and clubs. They listened respectfully to what the candidate had to say, but they were afraid to make the least gesture of greeting, except for a few farmhands who, armed with picks and shovels, rushed to surround him and cheered until they were hoarse, because they had nothing to lose. They were nomads who wandered the countryside without regular work, without families, without masters, and without fear. Shortly after the death and memorable interment of Pedro Garcia, Blanca began to lose her apple-colored freshness and to suffer from a natural fatigue that was not the result of holding her breath, and from morning nausea that was not the result of drinking heated brine. She thought it was from eating too much food. It was the season of golden peaches, apricots, and young corn cooked with basil in clay casseroles. It was the season for making marmalade and jam for winter. But neither fasting, chamomile, purgatives, nor rest could cure her. She lost her enthusiasm for the school, the infirmary, and even her ceramic creches. She grew weak and somnolent, and could spend hours lying in the shade looking up at the sun, uninterested in anything else. The only activities she kept up were her nocturnal escapes out of the window, where she had a rendezvous with Pedro III down by the river. Jean de Satigny, who had not admitted defeat in this romantic siege, observed her closely. Out of discretion, he had spent several periods in the hotel in town and made a few brief journeys to the capital, from which he would return weighed down with brochures about chinchillas, their hutches, their feeding, their sicknesses, their reproductive habits, the method for tanning their skins, and everything else that had to do with those tiny beasts who were destined to be converted into stoles. The Count spent most of the summer as a guest at Tres Marias. He was a delightful visitor, well-educated, light-hearted, and calm. He always had a friendly word on the tip of his tongue and was as ready to celebrate the cooking as he was to entertain his hosts by playing the piano in the sitting room, where his execution of the Chopin nocturnes rivaled Clara's. He was an inexhaustible source of anecdotes. He woke up late in the morning and devoted an hour or two to the care of his own person. First, he would do his exercises and run around the house, oblivious to the taunts of the hardy peasants looking on. Next, he would soak himself in a hot bath, and then he would take his time selecting his clothing for every occasion in the day. This last activity was a wasted one, because no one appreciated his elegance, and often the only thing he achieved with his British riding outfits, his velvet jackets, and his Tyrolean hats with their little feathers, was that Clara, with the best intentions, would offer him clothing more appropriate for the country. Jean did not lose his good humor. He accepted the ironic smiles of the owner of the house, Blanca's grimaces, and the perennial distraction of Clara, who even after a year was still asking him his name. He knew how to prepare a few French dishes, perfectly seasoned and magnificently presented, which were his contribution whenever there were guests for dinner. It was the first time any of them had seen a man interested in cooking, but they supposed it must be a European custom and did not dare make fun of him for fear of seeming ignorant. Besides the material on chinchillas, he also brought from the capital the popular wartime booklets that had been created to propagate the image of the heroic soldier and sentimental novels he had bought for Blanca. In after-dinner conversation, he sometimes referred, in a tone of utter boredom, to summers spent with the European nobility in the castles of Liechtenstein or the Côte d'Azur. He never missed an opportunity to say how happy he was to have traded all that for the enchantment of America. Blanca would ask him why he had not chosen the Caribbean, or at least a country with mulatas, coconut palms, and drums if what he was after was the exotic. But he maintained that there was no place on earth as pleasant as this half-forgotten country at the end of the earth. The Frenchman never spoke of his private life, except to slip in certain subtle hints that would enable an astute observer to recognize his splendid past, his incalculable fortune, and his noble origins. There was no consensus on his civil status, his age, his family, or the region of France he came from. Clara felt that so much mystery was dangerous and tried to penetrate it with her tarot cards, but Jean would not permit his fortune to be told or the lines of his hands to be read, nor did they know his astrological sign. Esteban Trueba was not the slightest bit concerned about any of this. For him, it was enough that the Count was willing to join him in a game of chess or dominoes, that he was clever and friendly, and never asked to borrow money. Ever since Jean de Satigny had begun to visit them, the boredom of the countryside, where after 5 o'clock in the afternoon there was nothing left to do, had become less oppressive. Besides, he liked the idea that his neighbors envied him for having this distinguished guest at Tres Marias. Word had got out that Jean was wooing Blanca, but that did not prevent his remaining the favorite of all the matchmaking mothers of the area. As for Blanca, she gradually adjusted to his presence. He was so discreet and gentle that she finally forgot about his proposal. She even thought it might have been some sort of joke on the Count's part. She took the silver candlesticks from the cupboard again, set the table with the English china, and once more wore her city dresses to the family's late afternoon gatherings. Jean often invited her into town or asked her to accompany him on his numerous social engagements. On such occasions, Clara had to go with them, because Esteban Trueba was unyielding when it came to this. He did not want his daughter to be seen alone with the Frenchman. He would, however, allow them to walk unchaperoned around the property, provided that they did not go too far and that they returned before dark. Clara said that if the point was to protect their daughter's virginity, that was a lot more dangerous than letting her go to tea at the Uzcategui family hacienda. But Esteban was confident that there was nothing to worry about with Jean, since his intentions were noble enough and that they only had to watch out for malicious gossips, who could easily destroy their daughter's reputation. Jean and Blanca's country walks consolidated their friendship. They did, after all, get along well. They both liked to go horseback riding in the middle of the morning, with a picnic basket and an array of canvas and leather bags containing Jean's belongings. At every stop, the Count posed Blanca against the landscape and took her picture, although she put up a certain resistance because she felt rather ridiculous. This feeling was borne out when she saw the developed photographs, where Blanca appeared with a smile that was not her own, standing in an uncomfortable position with an unhappy look that, according to Jean, was due to her inability to pose naturally, and according to Blanca, to the fact that he forced her to stand all twisted and to hold her breath for endless seconds until the plate had absorbed the image. They usually picked a shady place beneath the trees, where they spread a blanket on the grass and settled in for a few hours. They spoke of Europe, of books, of anecdotes from Blanca's family, or of Jean's voyages. She gave him a book by the poet, and he was so excited by it that he memorized long sections of it and could recite them perfectly. He said it was the best poetry ever written, and that even in French, the language of the arts, there was nothing to compare it to. They never talked about their feelings. Jean was solicitous, but he was not pleading or insistent. If anything, he was fraternal and light-hearted. If he kissed her hand, it was to bid her good night. He did it with a schoolboy look on his face that drained all romanticism from the gesture. If he admired a dress she was wearing, a dish she had prepared, or one of her crèche figures, his tone had an ironic touch to it that allowed her to interpret his words in many ways. If he gathered flowers for her or helped her down from her horse, he did it with a casualness that transformed his chivalry into a simple act of friendship. In any case, just to be on the safe side, every time she had an opportunity, Blanca let him know that she would never marry him, not even if her life depended on it. Jean de Satigny would smile his sparkling, seductive smile without saying a word, and Blanca could not help noticing that he was a lot more handsome than Pedro III. Blanca did not know that Jean was spying on her. He had seen her slip out the window in men's clothing many times. He would follow her part of the way, but he always turned back, afraid that the dogs would attack him in the dark. But from the way she was headed, he knew she always went to the river. Meanwhile, Trueba still had not made up his mind about the chinchillas. As a sort of test, he had agreed to set up a cage with a few pairs of the rodents, imitating, on a reduced scale, the enterprise under consideration. It was the one and only time anyone saw Jean de Satigny with his sleeves rolled up for work. Nonetheless, the chinchillas came down with a disease peculiar to rats, and they were all dead within 2 weeks. He could not even tan their skins, because their fur turned dark and fell from the hide as easily as feathers from the skin of a boiled fowl. Jean stared in horror at the bald cadavers, with their stiff little feet and empty eyes, his hopes dashed of convincing Esteban Trueba, who lost all interest in the fur trade, at the sight of such extensive loss of life. If this had hit a whole factory, I would have been completely ruined, Trueba concluded. Between the plague of the chinchillas and Blanca's escapades, the Count wasted several months of his time. He was growing weary of all the negotiations, and he could see that Blanca was never going to notice his charms. He could also see that the rodent farm would never be a reality. So he decided that he had better hasten things along before some clever fellow won the heiress. Besides, he was beginning to like Blanca, now that she was more robust and had acquired that languor that was smoothing away her rough, peasanty edges. He preferred women who were placid and well-rounded, and the sight of Blanca stretched out on cushions looking up at the sky during their siesta reminded him of his mother. At times, she even moved him. From a host of small details, imperceptible to others, Jean learned to guess when she was planning one of her nocturnal excursions to the river. She would sit through the evening meal without eating, on the pretext that she had a headache, and ask to be excused early from the table. There would be a strange gleam in her eyes, and an impatience and eagerness in her motions that he had come to recognize. One night, he decided to follow her all the way, to put an end to a situation that threatened to continue indefinitely. He was sure that Blanca had a lover, but he did not think it could be anything serious. Personally, Jean de Satigny had no particular fixation on virginity, and he had not raised the issue when he asked her hand in marriage. What interested him and her were other things which could not be lost in a moment of pleasure at the river's edge. After Blanca retired to her room and the rest of the family had left for theirs, Jean de Satigny remained behind in the dark drawing room, his ear cocked to the sounds of the house, until he calculated that she would be climbing out the window. He went out into the courtyard and stood under the trees to wait for her. He squatted in the shadows for more than half an hour, with nothing out of the ordinary disturbing the peace of the evening. Bored with waiting, he was just getting ready to go to bed when he noticed that Blanca's window was wide open. He realized that she must have leapt before he had positioned himself in the garden to observe her. Merde, he muttered. Hoping that the dogs would not alert the entire household with their barking and that they would not jump him, he began walking toward the river, taking the path he had seen Blanca take many times before. He was not used to walking the plowed earth in his elegant shoes or jumping over stones and sidestepping puddles, but the night was very bright, with a beautiful full moon that lit the sky with a phantasmagoric splendor. As soon as he had overcome his fear of the dogs, he was able to appreciate the beauty of the moment. He walked for at least a quarter of an hour before glimpsing the first beds of rushes along the riverbanks. He redoubled his caution and walked even more quietly, being careful not to give himself away by stepping on any branches. The moon was reflected in the water with a glassy brilliance, and the breeze gently stirred the rushes and the treetops. Absolute silence reigned, and for a moment he had the illusion that he was in a dream of a sleepwalker, in which he walked and walked without getting anywhere, always remaining in the same enchanted place where time had stopped and where if you tried to touch the trees, which looked within hand's reach, you found only empty space. He had to make an effort to recover his usual state of mind, which was realistic and pragmatic. In a bend of the river, between huge gray rocks lit by the moon, he saw them, so close that he could almost touch them. They were naked. The man had his back to him, but he had no difficulty recognizing the Jesuit priest who had helped officiate the funeral mass of old Pedro Garcia. This surprised him. Blanca slept with her head resting on the smooth brown stomach of her lover. The frail light of the moon threw metallic rays across their bodies, and Jean de Satigny shivered at the sight of Blanca, who at that moment seemed to him the image of perfection. It took the elegant French count nearly a minute to come out of the dreamlike state into which he had been swept by the sight of the lovers, the moon, and the silence of the surrounding fields, and to realize that the situation was far more serious than he had imagined. In the lovers' postures, he could see the abandon typical of those who have known each other for a long time. What he was looking at did not at all resemble an erotic summer idyll, as he had supposed, but rather a marriage of body and soul. Jean de Satigny could not have known that Blanca and Pedro III had slept this way the first day they met, and that they had continued doing so every time they could over all these years. Still, he knew it instinctively. Trying not to make even the slightest sound, he turned and began walking back to the main house, wondering how to handle the situation. When he reached the house, he had already decided to tell Blanca's father, because Esteban Trueba's ever-ready anger seemed to him to be the best means for solving the problem. "Let the natives work it out among themselves," he thought. Jean de Satigny did not wait for morning. He knocked on his host's door, and before Trueba had shaken off his sleep, he hurled his version of the story at him. He said he had been unable to sleep because of the heat, and that he had gone out for air, wandered down toward the river, and come upon the depressing spectacle of his future bride sleeping in the arms of the bearded priest, naked in the moonlight. For just a moment, this threw Trueba off course, because he could not imagine his daughter going to bed with Father José Dulce María. But he quickly realized what had happened, and understood the joke that had been played on him during the old man's funeral, realizing that his daughter's seducer was none other than Pedro III García, that son of a bitch who would pay for this the rest of his life. He hitched up his pants, pulled on his boots, threw his rifle over his shoulder, and grabbed his riding whip from the wall. "Wait here for me, Don," he ordered the Frenchman, who in any case had no intention of accompanying him. Esteban Trueba ran to the stable and mounted his horse without bothering to saddle it. He was panting with indignation, his bones locked in position and feeling the effort, his heart pounding in his chest. "I'm going to kill them both," he muttered over and over like a litany. He followed the road in the direction the Frenchman had indicated, but he had no need to ride all the way to the river, because halfway there he ran into Blanca, who was returning to the house, humming as she walked, her hair disheveled, her clothing dirty, with the happy look of those who have nothing else to ask from life. When he saw his daughter, Esteban Trueba was unable to restrain his evil character, and he charged her with his horse, whip in the air, beating her mercilessly, lash upon lash, until the girl fell flat and rigid on the ground. Her father jumped down from his horse, shook her until she came to, and shouted every insult known to man, plus others he made up in the heat of the moment. "Who is it? Tell me who it is or I'll kill you." "I'll never tell," she sobbed. Then Esteban Trueba understood that this was not the way to get something from his daughter, who had inherited his own stubbornness. He realized that, as always, he had got carried away with his punishment. He put her up on the horse, and they returned to the house. Either instinct or the barking of the dogs had alerted Clara and the servants, who were waiting in the doorway with all the lights blazing. The only person not to be found anywhere was the Count, who had taken advantage of the tumult to pack his bags, yoke the horses to his carriage, and leave discreetly for the hotel in town.
"My God, Esteban, what have you done?"
Clara exclaimed at the sight of her daughter, who was covered with mud and blood. Clara and Pedro Segundo García carried Blanca to her bed. The foreman had grown deathly pale, but he said nothing. Clara washed her daughter, applied cold compresses to her bruises, and rocked her until she had calmed down. After the girl was asleep, she went to confront her husband, who had locked himself in his study and was pacing furiously up and down, beating the walls with his whip, cursing and kicking all the furniture. When he saw her, Esteban vented his rage on Clara. He accused her of having raised Blanca without morals, without religion, without principles, like a libertine atheist, even worse, without a sense of her own class, because you could understand if she wanted to do it with someone from a decent family, but not with this hick, this simpleton, this hothead, this lazy good-for-nothing son of a bitch. I should have killed him when I said I would. Sleeping with my daughter. I swear I'm going to find him, and when I lay my hands on him, I'm going to cut his balls off if it's the last thing I ever do. I swear on my mother's soul he's going to regret that he was ever born.
Pedro Tercero Garcia hasn't done a thing you haven't done yourself, Clara said when she could interrupt him. You also slept with unmarried women not of your own class. The only difference is that he did it for love. And so did Blanca.
Treba stared at her, paralyzed with surprise. For a second, his fury seemed to deflate, and he felt as if she were making fun of him. But a wave of blood immediately rushed to his brain. He lost control and struck her in the face, knocking her against the wall. Clara fell to the floor without a sound. Esteban seemed to awaken from a trance. He knelt by her side, crying and begging for forgiveness, trying to explain, calling her by all the special names he used only when they were in bed, not understanding how he could have raised his hand against her. The only human being he really cared about and for whom he had never, not even in the worst moments of their common life, lost respect. He picked her up in his arms, seated her lovingly in an armchair, wet a handkerchief to put on her forehead, and tried to make her drink a little water. Finally, Clara opened her eyes. Blood was flowing from her nose. When she opened her mouth, she spat out several teeth which fell to the floor, and a thread of bloody saliva trickled down her chin and neck. As soon as Clara was able to move, she pushed Esteban out of her way, rose with great difficulty, and left the study, trying to walk as erect as she could. At the other side of the door was Pedro Segundo Garcia, who managed to grab her just as she stumbled. Sensing him beside her, Clara collapsed. She pressed her swollen face against the shoulder of this man who had stood beside her through all the worst moments of her life, and she began to cry. Pedro Segundo Garcia's shirt was stained with blood. Clara never spoke to her husband again. She stopped using her married name and removed the fine gold wedding ring that he had placed on her finger 20 years before, on that memorable night when Barrabás was assassinated with a butcher's knife. 2 days later, Clara and Blanca left Tres Marías and returned to the capital. Esteban, humiliated and furious, remained with the sensation that something in his life had been destroyed forever. Pedro Segundo drove his mistress and her daughter to the station. After that night, he was never again to see them, and he was silent and withdrawn. He helped them to their seats on the train, and then stood with his hat on his hand and his eyes lowered, not knowing how to say goodbye. Clara hugged him. At first, he was stiff and somewhat taken aback, but his own emotions quickly triumphed, and he timidly encircled her with his arms and left an imperceptible kiss on her cheek. They looked at each other through the window for the last time, and their eyes filled with tears. The faithful administrator returned to his small brick house, made a bundle of all his personal belongings, wrapped the small amount of money he had managed to accumulate over the years in a handkerchief, and left. Treba saw him say goodbye to the other tenants and climb up on his horse. He tried to stop him, explaining that what had happened had nothing to do with him, and that it was not right that he should lose his job, his friends, his house, and his security because of his son. I don't want to be here when you find my son, patron. Were the last words Pedro Segundo Garcia spoke before trotting off in the direction of the highway.
I felt so alone after that. I didn't know then that loneliness would never leave me, and that the only person I would ever have close to me the rest of my life would be an eccentric bohemian granddaughter with green hair like Rosa's. But that was still many years ahead of me. After Clara left, I looked around and noticed many new faces at Tres Marias. My old friends had either died or gone away. I had lost my wife and my daughter. My contact with my sons was minimal. My mother, my sister, dear old Nana, and old Pedro Garcia were all dead. Even Rosa returned to haunt me like an unforgettable grief, and I could no longer count on Pedro Segundo Garcia, who had stood beside me for 35 years. I couldn't stop crying. The tears would run down my face, and I would brush them off with my hand, but they were followed by others. "Why don't you all go to hell?" I would roar into the far corners of the house. I wandered through the empty rooms, went into Clara's bedroom and rifled her wardrobe and her dresser in the hope of finding something she had worn, anything, so I could hold it to my nose and retrieve, even for a fleeting instant, that sweet, clean smell of hers. I would lie down on her bed, bury my face in her pillow, caress the objects she had left on her night table, and feel completely desolate. Pedro Tercero Garcia was the one to blame for everything that had happened. Because of him, Blanca had left me. Because of him, I had fought with Clara. Because of him, Pedro Segundo had left the hacienda, and the tenants looked at me with hatred in their eyes and whispered behind my back. He had always been a troublemaker. What I should have done was kick him out at the very beginning. But out of respect for his father and grandfather, I let things go. And the upshot was that the insolent trash took what I most loved in the whole world. I went to the police station in town and bribed the guardsmen to help me look for him. I ordered them not to lock him up, but to turn him over to me without any fuss. In the bar, the barber shop, the club, and at the Red Lantern, I let it be known that there would be a reward for anyone who delivered him to me. "Watch out, patron. Don't start taking the law into your own hands," they warned me. Things have changed a lot since the days of the Sanchez brothers. But I didn't want to listen. What would the law have done in a case like this? Nothing. A couple of weeks went by without incident. I rode out to inspect my lands, paid a few visits to the neighboring haciendas, kept my eye on the tenants. I was convinced they were hiding the boy from me. I raised the amount of the reward and threatened to have the guardsmen dismissed for incompetence, but all to no avail. With each passing hour, my anger grew. I began to drink as I never had before, not even when I was a bachelor. I slept badly and dreamt again of Rosa. One night I dreamt I was beating her the way I had Clara, and that her teeth also fell out on the floor. I woke up screaming, but I was all alone, and there was no one to hear me. I was so depressed I even stopped shaving, didn't change my clothes, and I don't think I bathed either. Everything I ate tasted sour to me. I had a taste of bile in my mouth. I broke my knuckles banging on the walls, and rode a horse to death galloping off the fury that was eating me alive. No one came near me in those days. The maid's hands shook when they served my food, which only made me madder. One day I was in the hallway smoking a cigarette just before the siesta, when a dark little boy appeared in front of me and stood there silently. His name was Esteban Garcia. He was my grandson, but I didn't know it. Only now, with all the terrible things that happened at his hand, have I learned how we were related. He was also the grandson of Pancha Garcia, a sister of Pedro Segundo, whom I have to admit, I don't remember. "What do you want, kid?" I asked him.
"I know where Pedro Tercero Garcia is," he told me.
I gave such a jump that I upset the wicker chair I had been sitting in. I grabbed the boy by the shoulders and shook him. "Where? Where is the bastard?" I shouted.
"Are you going to give me the reward?"
the child stammered, frightened to death. "Don't worry,"